have all a world line, they'll become like part, yes, very massive particles of mass for the one over G space. If they are one dimensional, in space time, they'll become like they're like states. Two dimensional, they have like they're like surfaces and so on. Always with tension, which is for the one over G state.
Can we ever measure them?
Sorry,
so could we ever detect them?
Oh, I mean, our universe is almost surely not a perturbative string theory, so and the distinction between strings and librains is a very perturbative notion. So whatever non-perturbative process lead to universe looks like ours, it would mix the degrees of mix up the degrees of freedom considerably. So it makes sense to say, oh, this is a string that is a debris. See, the funny thing is that the string coupling is order one. And you look at something like actually string theory. There is a lot of democracy among invariants and strings. There is really a whole collection of string like objects, virus membrane, high dimensional objects. If the coupling is made small, one of the string objects is much lighter than the others. And somehow, quantizing that light object gives you information about all of the other ones. All of the other ones appear as the debris appear as these things. That's funny and interesting because we don't even know how to quantize membranes or higher dimensional objects. Somehow, in different limits, the same theories describe a completely different degrees of freedom. This is not unusual, in the sense that it can happen even in quantum theories. But it's still difficult to wrap your head around it. I mean, even in what's called Nikolov-Foster-Mills, which is a very supersymmetric version of the Mills theory, when the coupling is weak, it's a theory of gluons. And then there are other potential excitations in the theory which look like solitons, like magnetic monopoles, sort of things like that. But if you make the coupling very large, at some point these magnetic monopoles start behaving like gluons of a different H theory. And the original gluons start behaving like solitons of those gluons. So the fact that degrees of freedom can recognize themselves in interesting ways, in a given perturbative description, some might be elementary particles, some might be solitonic objects. It's a general principle. When applied to string theory, there are limits where it's the typical string theory, since there's some light objects which have a perturbative description, and all the other objects are kind of a solitonic description. They look like sources or field formations or something like that. But, and it's unclear if there is yet another non-perturbative description with definition which has completely different degrees of freedom, in terms of which everything, including the strings, are some kind of derived notion. In a DSCFT, that's definitely the case. So a DSCFT relates string theory in some funny space-time to the technical force that Mills was mentioning, and the elementary strings propagating in this space-time arise as confining strings roughly. It's not a very precise statement. This intuitive level, let me pass it, sort of flux strings of the Young-Mills theory. Any other questions? Okay, so in order to, so the construction of super string theories might look a bit strange. It introduces a whole bunch of new ingredients. You might wonder where do they come from. Now, a good intuition, source of intuition to understand where those ingredients are introduced, is to think about the quantum field theory, the blind formalism. How would you introduce fermions? So, at the very beginning of this lecture, right, we started with some way to describe propagators as an integral for some proper time, or maybe in Fourier transform. This becomes a sort of a Green function, which is written as an integral. Some simple action. And then perhaps this is recognized as a gauge fixed version. It's more complicated parametrization invariant action. Remember these steps? So, what if I want a Dirac propagator? What are the analogous steps I can do? I mean, clearly, if I try to do something, the very first question you should ask is, how do I get gamma matrices? So starting from this action, it was not unreasonable that I get a space of single particle states, which is labeled by momenta. Just because when I quantize this action, I have position, I get position momentum operators, standard Heisenberg algebra, and there is natural basis, which is the basis of momenta. And then I get an initial condition from gauge fixing or whatever else, integrating of this parameter or whatever else. Now, here I need something that, besides the momenta, gives me operators that behave like gamma matrices. I need some quantum mechanics which is equipped with operators which behave like gamma matrices. In order to really remember that I'm trying to build some operators that behave like gamma matrices, let me just give them another name, like the size. I want somehow to build the quantum mechanics for which there's these commutation relations. This means that my Hilbert space will be a bit richer. We'll now have maybe something which momentum can appear, but also something based like gamma matrices. Another point is that on shell conditions just be different, right? Here the shell condition is P squared equal to zero, or P squared equal to minus P squared. For fermions, my on shell condition is linear in momentum. And it implies the usual Russian condition. So somehow, something must happen to this sort of gauge fixing procedure too. Or to this proper time. So I will need some extra ingredient, some extra gauge symmetry, essentially, so that when I gauge fix that extra gauge symmetry, the constraint will look like this. Now, it's pretty simple to write down an action which is this is commutation relations. You can do something like x dot squared plus psi dot psi. Psi is customer. With this action, psi is on conjugate momentum. But this is a useful bosonic, this will be a total derivative. That will be pretty boring. Because it's fermionic, this is not a total derivative, it's not psi squared, of which this is the derivative of. So, when you quantize these actions, I mean, so psi is on conjugate momentum, and so you get anti commutation ratio, because it's a Kasparov variable, of this simple form. So if I have an action of this sort, I get a space of states which will be labeled by momenta and by some other variables, or the discrete variable, and the psis will just act as gamma matrices.
Reasonable to say that the
size
act as gamma matrices?
Well, gamma matrices are solutions to this equation, right? Mm-hmm. By definition. Gamma matrices are an irreducible solution to these equations.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Clifford algebra. The Clifford algebra has irreducible, essentially one irreducible representation, or two, depending on the dimensionality. And the gamma matrices are just the way the Clifford algebra acts on that representation.
So these Grassmann numbers, you're putting them in the world sheet, right?
Oh, yeah, world line
from that, yes.
Oh, okay, yeah, but then the mu nu,
mm-hmm.
would it run in the total dimension of
it? Yes, the run of space-time. So it's kind of funny, right? I have a bunch of coordinates to describe the motion of the string in space-time, and then I have another completely parallel set of fermionic coordinates. And you can ask, what do this mean? You try to interpret this as sort of a doubled up space-time, a space-time which has a certain number of bosonic directions and a certain number of fermionic directions. But there is actually a better way to think about it. So, see, the simplest way I could try to write down something like that is doing this. Where L is a bosonic variable, and Z is a fermionic variable. Because then when I do the zeta integral, it pulls down this gamma B. It's also quite natural because the gammas are realized in terms of size, so they're just not variables. I would put something as exponential.
It's natural to multiply another just not variable.
So, this seems to suggest that perhaps I should work with word lines which have a bosonic and a fermionic direction. To understand this point even better, let's look at the Hamiltonian of this system. The Hamiltonian of this system is simply E squared. But there is another interesting operator. I'll call it Q, but let's be careful, this is not a DST charge.
It's nothing to do with DST charge. So from now on, whenever I've done a DST charge, I'll call it a Q DST.
There is another operator here, which is P mu, gamma mu, psi mu.
this operator commutes with Hamiltonian.
So it's a symmetry. It describes the symmetry of this theory.
It expresses the fact that this theory somehow has a set of bosonic and fermionic coordinates
which look the same.
And so there's a symmetry mapping one into the other. For example, if I do q hat q to x, this maps it to psi. If I do q hat commutator psi, this maps it to t. It's also known as x hat x dot. The symmetry, it has another nice property that q squared is the Hamiltonian. So this is a very simple example
of a supersymmetric theory.
It's a theory which has a conserved charge, which is Grassmann odd, and squares the translation. In this case, time translation. On the worksheet, on the word line. So this is a supersymmetric word line theory. It's amusing to introduce a variable dual to the charge in the same sense as time is equal to the Hamiltonian. So you can sort of remember the way you make operators time dependent, right, in quantum mechanics is that you do something like this. I might have my eyes fixed now, right? So, why not try to generalize this? Let me go to Euclidean time. Say something like eat the tau h hat plus theta hat o. It's the minus tau h hat minus theta hat and call this O of tau and theta. I can do that. So it's natural to think of my operators as a sort of living on a super line, something which is a bosonic time coordinate and a fermionic time super time coordinate. Now there are some. So in particular, I could define something like this. This operation x
at zero,
I get something like this. I just gave it a slightly different name not to confuse x, x. So I get x evolved in time. And so you see that this psi is sort of the first derivative of the coordinate with respect to the coordinate. So in a sense, this is a theory of maps from a super word line to a standard space-time. So here there is no supersymmetry in space-time. Supersymmetry is on the word line. Are there any questions?
That theta is that still a Grassmann variable?
Yes.
So this y would leave. It's not the usual space-time, right?
Well, this combination is bosonic.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So this is just a generic bosonic function of time.
That's super time.
Now, the fact that super time translations, square to translations, makes the geometry of this super line a little bit unusual. But usually, whenever a space-time some space with two coordinates, I'm used to translation of one coordinate and translation of the other coordinate to just be something events which are they commute. Instead, translation along this coordinate does not anti-commute itself. The anti-commutator is translation along this coordinate. You can think about the superline as a kind of a Lie, Lie algebra, Lie group. So there is some non-trivial, like, no, like in a sphere, right? In a sphere, rotations. If I'm studying a space-time which looks like a shoe, rotations in three directions don't commute. It's not a flat. So in this case, in this sense, the superline is not fully flat. It has a little bit of group structure. So when you do a translation to something like y, to the translation, you get something like psi mu minus theta mu. You could also think about it as the theta minus theta the tau of y. So the supersymmetric transformation, because of this, this supersymmetry generator, it really corresponds to the translation of theta combined with the translation of long time. It's useful to introduce another object, which is called the superderivative, which has the opposite sign. It's convenient because this anti-commutes with Q. So when you try to write down actions, for example, which have symmetry Q, it's very convenient to write them in terms of the superderivatives. And again, the superderivative squared is translation along time. And I could keep going with this example, write down how to write actions in this sort of superspace and so on. But I will not do so. Not necessary for what we're going to do next. Instead, I want to ask what could be the generalization of this step. So here we went from a theory which was defined on a real line and had translation symmetry to a theory which had diffeomorphism invariants. So the question I would like to ask is, how do I generalize this sort of translations to something like a super diffeomorphism invariants? So of course you could say, well, I can try to use coordinate redefinitions, just generic coordinate redefinitions. Right? I could say I take my time and I make it some function of time and theta. Then I take my theta and I make it some other function of time and theta. If I do that, I get a group of transformations, which is nice, but has a lot of degrees of freedom. It includes two bosonic variables, two bosonic degrees of freedom, and two fermionic degrees of freedom. That seems a little too much, right? We're trying to reproduce a non-shell condition, which has sort of one bosonic and one fermionic component. And the bosonic component is actually related to the fermionic component in a simple way. If I try to work out the theory which has invariants under these transformations and gauge fixes, I'll probably end up with many constraints. Also, I'm not aware of, it's actually pretty difficult to write down So it's pretty I don't think you can write down an action which is invariant under this and which kind of looks like this. Which will give this gauge fixed action. See, here somehow it was important to have this relation. And I want to keep a similar structure. I don't want to break down this sort of group of the algebra structure which I gave to the detector of variables. Concretely, what this means is that I want a transformation which maps the theta to some multiple of the theta prime without mixing it with the tau. This is the constraint I want to impose. So that somehow this preferred direction, this preferred differential operator, is mapped to a multiple of itself. This also makes it easier to write down actions that are invariant under this supermorphism. So this is called the supermorphism group. And manifolds built out of local patches which use this state tau and theta coordinate and coordinate transformations which preserve this constraint are what would be natural to call super one-dimensional super manifolds. Although the terminology is not universal. So you can just plug in these transformations in theta and see which constraints you need to satisfy for them to hold. It's not a terribly difficult exercise, so it can get a little tedious. But instead, what I'm going to do is to just write down one generator of infinitesimal transformations which definitely has this property and move on from there. So I'm going to describe for you the most general odd supermorphism. So it's a vector field which is built out of a single function. And it's just a function of time times this. So it's the most sort of, I took my Q transformation and I made it position dependent. It's easy to check that when this maps the theta to a multiple of itself. So if you take the Poisson bracket, this vector field, then the theta, you get, what was it here? Something which is proportional to the theta. So this satisfies the constraint I wanted. Then another thing you can do is to ask what happens if I take the commutator of two of these transformations. And you get a more complicated expression, which has the term proportional to the time derivative, and then a correction. Staring at this gives you the most general form of a bosonic supermorphism. It's some sort of f of tau d tau plus 1/2 the tau f theta the theta.
You can check that this also preserve maps the theta to the multiple of itself. And you can also check that this transformation and this transformation flows an algebra. So there is really a nice super diffeomorphism group generated by this and this. Okay. So essentially, let me just write this. Let me give you a name to this. Let me call this B of F. So this is just D of FG minus 2FG.
So you're saying that any diffeomorphism I can write as a linear combination of either the type that V is,
yes,
or the type that...
That's right, any super diffeomorphism.
Okay. And did you say that the first one was you called odd?
It's odd because it's a bosonic function multiplying something odd.
Right.
Yes, this is even because there is a bosonic function multiplying something as an even. Mm-hmm. So this super group of super diffeomorphisms is a super group. It has bosonic and fermionic directions in the algebra. These are the fermionic directions, these are the bosonic directions, and then the commutator of two fermionic directions is a bosonic direction.
I see. Thanks.
This is putting this tau dependence is already making supersymmetry local, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So we're kind of doing supergravity?
That's correct, yes. Okay. So this action was essentially an action of one-dimensional gravity. This field E that we introduced was really secretly a metric. And indeed, if I want to have a theory which has local diffeomorphism invariance, I pretty much need to put in a metric. And this was the natural action, right? In terms of a metric, and this X field. A theory which has super local super diffeomorphism invariance could be a theory of supergravity by definition. It's going to have a metric and something else called the gravitino. So the metric is kind of a spin two field, but I'm wearing one dimension, so that not sure makes no sense. So all means that there will be some action, which I'm not sure is worth writing down because it's probably better to just move on to this sort of thing. But anyway, the act will have some action with this function of x and psi, and it's function of some gravitino, graviton, and gravitino. So Grassmann even and Grassmann odd.
And what about the big rotation? You big rotate in T, but do you also need to do that in this new time?
Well, fermions, Grassmann variables are formal variables anyway, so we rotating them doesn't really make any difference. Mm-hmm. Right, when you do a Grassmann integral, an integral over Grassmann odd variable, you don't have to specify the integration contour. Mm-hmm. So it's whenever you want to do a rotation, you have to just worry about that. And about the reality condition of the various
mm-hmm. objects here.
Okay, what else I wanted to say, yes. So I could write down this action with a bit of pain. So supergravity, one common theme of supergravity is to define supergravity actions. You need to just do a systematic procedure where you start from the action for the bosonic fields and you add corrections and try to fix the, it's an art really. There is just a community that for several years has written down all possible gravity actions. It was a
career work effort. They're written down, they're a finite collection in various space-time dimensions. It's a very sad moment if you realize that you need a gravity action nobody has written down. Because, I mean, there are shortcuts, there are forms of intuition, but there is no really completely algorithmic way to get to the actions. So, right, for example, here, what we would do is that we start from an action that looks like this, put in the metric in the most natural way, and do a variation under this V of F. And there will be some terms that don't cancel out in the variation. So we'll have to add some topics to the cavitino to compensate the variation. And keep going, adding higher and higher powers of gravitino until we stop. Here, luckily, there is only one gravitino, so and so the procedure stops relatively soon, but I don't think it's really worth writing down the details. The interesting point is that once you write down the transformations of the gravity and gravitino, you realize that there are sort of two gauge invariant quantities. So in the bosonic case, the only gauge invariant was the total length of the path. And here there is sort of the total length of the path and how much the path moves in the bosonic direction. So at the end of the story, when you gauge fix, you end up with some integral over bosonic length and this theta. And you can convince yourself that gauge fixing that supergravity action would at the end land on something like that.
So you want this supergravity action to be gauge invariant, you also want it to give you the same equations of motion, right?
So. Right, so you want to, after you gauge fix it, you want to go back here. And possibly to something like this. In particular, you would like the constraints of gauge fixing to look like this. And these are pretty reasonable constraints, right? They are sort of telling you, so this is just a statement that the Hamiltonian vanishes. It's kind of natural if you want to have invariance. It's like the equivalent of stress tensor equal to zero in the thing. And this is telling you the sort of Q vanishes on all the states. So these states are, which is reasonably natural for the story from a freezing invariance. Now, so let's just forget about all of this, but keep this. So I don't want to study theory of two-dimensional supergravity and gauge fix it carefully. It can be done. It's a lot of pain. Instead, why don't we try to generalize just the endpoint of that gauge fix? In the bosonic thing, we landed on surfaces which are locally flat and with patches related by conformal transformations, which are just generic maps sending z to some functions of z. Since coordinate complex transformations really look like a complexification, so conformal transformations in two dimensions really look like a complexification of the diffeomorphism group. The diffeomorphism group takes tau, the map is the function of tau. The conformal transformations in G take z, the map is the function of z. So we can just ask, can we build up surfaces where I have sort of a z and a theta, and a z bar and a theta bar, perhaps? And the patches are glued together by transformations like this. That's called the super Riemann surface. So super Riemann surface. the most obvious thing you can do, which you could call 1-1, is that locally you have patches, so you have coordinate z and theta, and z bar and theta bar. And then you map, you use maps where z goes to some prime is some function of z and theta, and theta prime is some function of z and theta, and so for z bar. Such that the differential operator d theta, which is d theta plus theta dz, maps to a multiple of d theta prime. And actually, if you look at the transformations, you can even give a name to that multiple. This Jacobian factor is really just the theta of theta prime.
This happens. This is called the super Jacobian. It's called the super Jacobian.
So here we have theta and theta bar, and we want the theta and the theta bar. First thing you can do. There's another slightly more exotic thing, which you could call 1,0, where you only have one theta. So your z and theta, your z bar, but you do not add a theta bar. And when you join, when you map coordinate patches, you take z prime as a function of z and theta, theta prime, which is a function of z and theta, but z bar prime is just a function of z bar. It might look a bit different, a bit strange to a completely different or different seeming transformation for z and z bar, but you can always think that you're in Euclidean coordinates, in the Lorentzian coordinates for z and z bar are just independent. Or you can just say that when you set the fermionic coordinates to zero, this is convex object this. Anyway, so this is called an ekerotic
Riemann surface, Riemann surface. And this is type 2 Riemann surface.
Mean 1-1. 1-1 just means I have one holomorphic theta and one
holomorphic theta.
1-0 means I have one holomorphic theta and one
anti-holomorphic theta.
So, so I can try to define quantum field theories on a super Riemann surface, which are invariant under these super Kochman transformations. So it turns out that the same way as when I define a theory on the Riemann surface, I get stress tensor, stress tensors, which sort of are the constant currents for these conformal transformations. If I look at a super Riemann surface, I get some super partners, which are called super currents. So this is sort of this secretly TZZ, right? So it has delta equal to 2, delta bar equal to 0. These ones, if you wrote them in coordinates, you would have one vector index and one spinor index on the surface. So they have spin 3/2. And are fermionic. you can sort of think about a big supercurrent, which is a function both of z and theta, which has leading components g of theta, g of t plus theta, g of t. So when I try to, in order to define a superstring theory, I want to impose constraint. I want to sort of study a theory like that on the super worksheet and impose constraints which set both t and g to zero. This will be analogous to this sort of constraints because both is Hamiltonian equal to zero and super translation equal to zero. So in a BRST quantization, I will introduce both B and C, which are associated to such a Q BRST B C.
Yes. So can I say that T corresponds to the bosonic directions of super diffeomorphisms?
Yes, absolutely. So if you want to write down the operators that implement the bosonic superdiffeomorphism, you will just integrate T against pretty much F. So integrate TF on some contour. And if you want to write down the operator which implements the odd super transformation, you will integrate G against F on some contour. The same way as you would have done for the bosonic theory.
And S is just like the total one that I could use for anything else.
That's right. So when you expand T in modes, you get on the cylinder, for example, you get the generators of diffeomorphisms, diffeomorphisms with parameters of the NS. When you expand G, they're going to get generators for the odd
diffeomorphisms.
Anyway, to impose the G0, the quantization, I will need a second set of ghosts, called them beta gamma, with a property that QRC beta is G. So C is a vector field, it's a ghost for capital F. And gamma is a spin, something with one spin or index, the dimension minus 1/2. And it's the ghost for this kind of physics. Okay. And so you can imagine sort of running the whole procedure that we run for the bosonic string. If I want to describe a superstring moving in space-time, in flat space-time, and has some field axis, that'll be x, the function of z, we call them skip x. But when you expand them out, you're going to find this our familiar axis, bosonic coordinates. We're gonna find so when you look at it carefully, you find that up to some auxiliary fields that pop out, your worksheet theory has some bosonic fields, which describe sort of bosonic space-time. And then some partners, which are fermions on the worksheet. The fermions on the worksheet, they still has space-time vector indices. So these are completely analogous to this size that we produce here. The action is something like del x del bar x plus psi del bar psi plus psi bar del psi bar. The stress tensor is del x squared minus psi del psi. You understand that because of this action, the psi is holomorphic. The psi bar is holomorphic. And the super curtain is essentially psi del x. This is quite straightforward. In order to do calculations in detail, the only thing that we would need is to refresh ourselves how massless free fermions on a dimensional surface look like, right? I mean, although I use this super Riemann surface in the back of my head to understand the symmetries and all that, at the end, I really just have some standard Riemann surface, at least locally. I have just a complex plane, or the cylinder or something like that, with this bosonic fermion excuse. So if I want the spectrum of the super string theory, I would just look at the Fock space of this axis and size, perhaps also the beta gamma system, the BC system, and impose constraints, impose the constraints t equal to 0, g equal to 0, pretty much, to find the shell spectrum. There is one interesting subtlety which is worth mentioning, to devote the last 5 minutes to, which is something called GSO projection in the string theory literature. And again, it's a fancy name for something which you would encounter just studying any dimensional quantum form of the theory. But at the time, people understanding of the dimensional form of the theory was not well developed, so it deserved its own name. So, do we need to discuss theories of fermions on the worksheet? Now, a fermion is a spinner. And in particular, it transforms by a fractional power of Jacobian. If you remember a vector, right, transformed by the first power of Jacobian, the spinner transforms like a square root of that. In particular, if I want to put the spinner on a surface which is built out of patches, it's not enough to tell me the coordinate transformation between patches. I also need to give you a square root of the Jacobian for each transition. I need to put extra structure on my surface. This is called a spin structure. Now, if I call conformal field theory a theory which is just defined on a Riemann surface without the conformal surface with a complex structure, let me call spin conformal field theory, conformal field theory which requires you to specify spin structure. So, a free fermion is an example of a spin conformal field theory, a spin conformal field theory. It requires just a little bit of extra structure, it's a topological extra piece of information, but it's still there. It turns out when you define spin theory, it's really more natural to use a conformal field theory rather than a spin conformal field theory. You can argue that if you try to use a spin theory, at the end of the manipulations you do will end up transforming the standard bosonic theory. So I would like to discuss briefly some simple topological manipulations you can do on quantum field theories, and of which the GSO projection is an example. But I don't know if in the Popov figure class you've seen anything about ugly faults. So I would not use that term. So let's say some theory with some space of observables, space of local operators. They call it a SOS, space of local operators. Now, it's perfectly possible for the theory to have a pretty large subset of local operators, which is closed under multiplication and under other manipulations. For example, take a theory which has a Z2 symmetry. Then the operators which are Z2 even are a closed subset. If you multiply two Z2 even operators, you get a Z2 even operator. So it's possible that inside here there is sort of some smaller set of local operators. Now you could ask, could I just take a theory from which these are the operators and nothing else? The answer is no. There are some consistency conditions which fail if you just try to say my theory has these local operators. This is pretty much related to the state operator map. Turns out when you put the theory on a complicated surface, when you start cutting the surface along tubes and seeing what the space of states that flow through those tubes, sometimes you find states which are not corresponding to these operators. But what's possible is that there might be another theory, and we call it prime, with another set of operators, which contains the same collection. So there is some general technology where you take some theory, you throw away, you focus on a pretty large subset of local operators, and then you try to complete it again to a different collection, finding a slightly different theory. These two theories have a lot in common. For example, if you do correlation functions on a sphere of these operators, you will not see the difference. But they give you different answers on complicated Riemann surfaces, on torus. It's also perfectly possible that one of these theories is bosonic, meaning does not require square roots of the Jacobian in definition, and the other one does. So there is an example which you guys are probably familiar with, which is the Ising model. Have you encountered the Ising model? What are the local operators of the Ising model?
Do you remember?
That's right. There is the identity and all its descendants, identities, transcendence, and so on. There is the spin operator and descendants, like the derivative of the spin, and so on. And then there is the energy operator, it's called the energy operator, the operator you would add to the theory to change the temperature in the statistical mechanic description of the Ising model. If you remember, this has dimension 116, this dimension 0, this dimension 1/2, 1/2. And there is a Z2 symmetry, right, in the Ising model? Which operators are even under the Z2 symmetry?
That flips the spin. The energy and the identity.
That's right. So. So inside here, there is a collection which consists only of the identity and of the energy operator and the descendants. Do you know any other theories which include this collection of operators? to work on this other solution organizing model might come to mind. Or Jordan Whitney transformation. You might have heard that the Ising model is solvable because it's related to the theory of preference. What the precise relation is that if I take a theory of preference, which is local operators 1, psi, psi bar, and psi psi bar, and their descendants, I can identify these with epsilon. And then I find this collection here. So the correct statement is that there is some kind of topological manipulation that relates the Ising model and the free fermion. This topological manipulation throws away operators of spin 1/2, keeps only operators of integral spin, and puts in new spin operators. Now, in this theory, there is no local operator sigma. The best you can do is to say, let me introduce something which leaves a cross at the end of a cut. I can put a cut where psi goes to minus psi, and psi bar goes to minus psi bar. They go around the cut. So if I consider a theory in this funny setup where some of the elementary fields are anti-periodic, then here I find something which has the same properties as sigma. Conversely, in this setup, if I introduce a cut across which sigma goes to minus sigma, at the end point, I can find things which behave like psi or psi bar. So the statement is that there is no local theory which has all the operators, which has 1, psi, psi bar, and sigma. But there are sort of collections of mutually local operators, each of which defines the theory. By the way, there is a third collection. It turns out at this end point, you can find sigma, you can find also something else called mu. You can find, so you can build another theory. You have 1, mu, and epsilon. And it turns out this is again an Ising model. This relation is usually called Kamevanier duality. If you go microscopically, realize this is a spin chain or something like that. And this relation is something called Jordan-Whitney transformation. They're not equivalences, but they are topological manipulations of a theory. Of a system which give you another system which is very similar dynamics but different global properties. So the Hilbert spaces of these theories, for example, so here I discussed local operators. I could have used the state operator map to discuss Hilbert spaces. But I said these theories have different Hilbert spaces on the circle, although there is some common subspace. So one important step in defining the theory of superstrings is to figure out what analogous thing that we can do when we have a whole bunch of psi and psi bars, and also these beta and gamma ghosts. So you can do something completely analogous to this. You say, I just throw away everything that has spin 1/2, half integral, and I only keep the operators of integral spin. That's called the type 0, just a projection, and gives a theory which has a type. Not very interesting. But there is an alternative that is only available in some special circumstances, which happens to hold here. Where you where you can say, no, I keep only operators which have integral spin both on the holomorphic and on the anti-holomorphic side. So I throw away not just psi and psi bar, I also throw away psi psi bar. I only keep things like psi psi, or psi 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 bar psi bar. This is called a type Schuggier operation, and it gives you the really interesting theories, because it happens to throw away the tacker. So it removes the state in the Hilbert space, which usually would be the tacker. In a sense, the ground state of the ghosts happen to be odd under this projection. So you throw away the ground state of the ghosts. And you only allow things which are built from the ground state with an odd number of psi and psi bars. And as a result, you get a nice spectrum which has no tachyon, but has a graviton and so on and so forth, and I'll discuss the details tomorrow. It's kind of funny that it's sort of chiral just a projection which sort of acts just on the holomorphic, separate the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts of the theory. In general, can have anomalies, which essentially tell you there is no way to complete the collection of operators or something that's consistent. But the anomaly is a number modulo 8, and each fermion contributes 1 to that, and the ghost contributes minus 2. And on a completely separate calculation, if you ask what is the critical dimension of these superstring theories, when is the BRST charge squares to 0, when is the wild anomaly vanishes, it vanishes when there are 10 dimensions. So if there are 10 dimensions, there are 10 psi's, 10 minus 2 is 8, and the anomaly vanishes, and you can do the interesting gist of projection. If you, anyway, not for now. If any more questions, whoever wants to escape the heat.
This super string,
yes,
is supposed to be equivalent to a string with target space supersymmetry.
So target space supersymmetry is an emergent symmetry. So it's vaguely analogous to the way the theory built here gained an extra symmetry. So after GSO projection, the spectrum of the superstring will include something which is a gravitino in spacetime. And that implies that the spacetime theory has supersymmetry.
Only after the GSO?
Only after the GSO projection.
How can you? Is there any particular intuitive reasoning why that should be, or just happens?
I'm
geometric interpretation or something?
Not clear at all. The emergence of target space supersymmetry in the superstring theory in this formalism is called Bourgeois-Samond. It's quite dark.